Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. And it's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, as the Prime Minister unveils a new national framework on artificial intelligence, we'll take you inside one of the world's biggest AI companies with a former board member of OpenAI.
I think the thing that's easiest to miss from outside Silicon Valley is how serious they are about making machines that really can compete with humans across the range of sort of all human endeavor and maybe outcompete humans. You know, these companies might be wrong about whether they can build those things and how long it will take them, but they really mean it and they are really putting everything they have into trying to get there.
Those insights coming up. Then you'll hear from Vice Chancellor Bill Shorten as the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion continues looking at universities today. And we'll also take a look at a really challenging story: the alleged murders of two women and two teenage girls by men known to them in just 1 week in Australia. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. So the Prime Minister is today outlining a shift in the way the federal government grapples with artificial intelligence. He's giving this major speech that'll flag centralising government oversight of AI issues so that the government isn't responding issue by issue and sector by sector. Now, before you hear from a former sector insider, let's hear from the federal government. Ahead of the Prime Minister's speech, Sally Sarah spoke with Andrew Charlton. He's the Assistant Minister for Science, Technology and also the Digital Economy.
Is this shift an acknowledgement that the piecemeal approach for dealing with AI hasn't worked adequately so far?
Well, today the PM is providing national leadership on a national issue. He is going to announce an Australian world first, that Australia will become the first country in the world to have a regulated national framework for large AI data centres. The government has been working methodically through these issues. We've released our data centre plan in December. We announced our framework for the way that data centres would be provided with standards in March, and technical bodies have been working through those over the last couple of months.
But the EU has already got some of these overall frameworks. What difference will it make establishing an office in the Prime Minister's department to oversee AI policy formulation?
Well, you know, we need to make sure that Australia shapes the future of how this technology is deployed. And there are many different levels of government that are involved in the way the large AI data centres are deployed. There are many different departments within government that have equities in this space. So the Prime Minister is bringing national leadership to the issue, and he'll be announcing important elements of that framework later today.
When we look at copyright, AI companies are looking to expand to Australia, but they say legal uncertainty over copyright and their tech is a hurdle in making significant investments here. In the government's view, is changing Australia's copyright laws now necessary to draw that investment?
Well, the government's position on this has not changed. We support the Australian creative sector. We have ruled out a text and data mining exemption, and we have said that where Australian copyrighted material is used, it must be used with the consent and with compensation for the creatives and copyright holders who made it. That has been our approach. It continues to be our approach. And I don't want to get ahead of the Prime Minister, but what you will hear today is a clear plan to deliver that national consistency.
And that was Andrew Charlton, the Assistant Minister for Science, Technology and also the Digital Economy. Well, Helen Toner is an Australian AI researcher who served on the board of emerging giant OpenAI back when co-founder Sam Altman was being dismissed from the company. She's now with Georgetown's Center for Security and Emerging Technology, and she came on this morning for a comprehensive interview with Sally about the PM's announcement, data centers, and the state of the AI sector.
Helen, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will today declare an end to an issue-by-issue approach to AI, instead wanting to centralise standards and regulation. How important is that, and how difficult will the task be to get everyone on the same page?
It'll be difficult to centralise everything because AI is such a wide-ranging technology. So I think there's been attempts in different places to go issue by issue or to centralise. Most famously, I think the US is very issue by issue, and the EU has tried to centralise with their AI Act. Both of those approaches have problems. So I'm sure the Prime Minister is hoping to be able to do some of the best of both worlds. It'll be interesting to see what the approach is.
The Prime Minister will say that Australia is the first country on earth to bring those issues into a single national framework. Is that right from what we understand globally?
I think that's a bit ambitious to say, especially in comparison to the EU, which does have this giant legislative framework that they, or, you know, big law that they pushed through a couple of years ago that they're now implementing. Of course, the EU isn't a country, so maybe he gets a pass on that. But it is challenging because AI touches so many different sectors. You've got healthcare, finance, education, national security, pretty much everything. Anywhere you could use software, you can probably use AI. So I think it's really a question of where do you leave the expertise in specific sectors that really know their sector, and where do you need to have that kind of AI-focused expertise, which should be more centralised.
This new office within the Prime Minister's department will design what's known as Australian standards for AI. What's that look like around the world? What kind of standards in particular are governments trying to enforce?
There's been a lot of different approaches to this. Again, the EU approach here has been to treat AI like a product. And so in the same way that if you have sort of a physical product in the EU, it might have a little stamp that it's gone through a certain testing process, is the way they've mostly thought about it. In the US, things tend to be much more decentralized. So, looking at self-driving cars, that really goes through the transportation. Anything medical is going to go through, the medical regulators. So I think I'm really interested to see how they're going to try to walk that line, because you can't, since you can use AI in so many different places, you can't just have AI experts sort of trying to figure out, an AI for something in the financial industry. They also need to have financial expertise to evaluate that, or AI for, airplanes. You need to have the aviation expertise. And so, I think what you would really want to ideally try and do is have some sort of hub and spokes model where you have AI expertise that can connect with, experts in those individual sectors and make sure that you're trying to combine the different types of expertise you need. It'll be challenging to get right, I think. But interesting thing to try.
Helen, we can't talk about AI without talking about data centres. In the past day, we've seen New York State in the US ordering a one-year moratorium on the construction of data centres. Is that something that we're likely to see more of as governments try to check the growing power of the industry?
I think there's a lot of public concern about data centres, and it's also an area where the public actually feels like they can do something about it. In a lot of places, if you're part of your local community, you can object to construction in a way that you can't necessarily object to, a big tech company implementing an AI feature in your email inbox or something like that. So it is also kind of a fruitful place where people can express opposition. I think what we're likely to see is that the industry is really recognizing that they need to do much, much more to get communities on side. I think they'll come up with ideas, but I think it took the industry a year or two to figure out that people actually really feel strongly about this, and an industry is going to need to try harder.
We're hearing a narrative again and again in Australia that Australia is a target for international investment for these data centres for a number of reasons. How do you see it when you look at the scene internationally?
Yeah, I mean, I think Australia has a lot to offer. I'm based in Washington, D.C., and, the U.S. tech companies really do feel the need to drastically expand how much computing power they have access to, which means building new data centres with new cutting-edge chips. They're trying to do that domestically here in the U.S., and they're building a lot, but they are running into, some bottlenecks as well. And so then they sort of look overseas. Australia is really interesting because, of course, there's potentially a lot of space, lots of sun, of course, And so perhaps could be good on the energy front if you can set that up right. The challenge, of course, is being a democracy. We want to really bring the public along and make that work well.
We're seeing here in Australia and in other places a big tug of war at the moment when it comes to protection of copyright, but also countries and locations wanting the investment of these data centres. How do you see that tug of war at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really showing that the way copyright law works right now is just made for a pre-AI era. I think no one would dispute that. And so with copyright, you're really trying to balance two things, right? You're trying to balance protecting the rights of the people who, you know, are creative or who produce content, who do the work, and making sure that they are compensated fairly, while also, you know, trying to make it possible for people to build on that, innovate, you know, produce new types of work. And different countries have sort of handled those trade-offs differently. I think what we're seeing around the world is that we just need to take a fresh look at how that works for this era. That's not to say that AI companies should just have free rein and be able to do whatever they want and not compensate people for work that they've done, because that's obviously, you know, going to lead to a collapse in people's ability to actually do creative work and create the things that that the AI companies need. But I don't think there's a country on earth that has a great setup right now. And so I think taking a look at it does make sense.
You've had a front row seat to what some of the big players in this industry are seeking and doing in this space. During your time on the OpenAI board, what was your sense of where these companies want to ultimately take this technology?
Yeah, I think the thing that's easiest to miss from outside Silicon Valley is how serious they are about making machines that really can compete with humans across the range of sort of all human endeavor and maybe outcompete humans, really, you know, talking not just about artificial general intelligence, which is usually used to mean AI that's kind of as smart as humans, but also artificial super intelligence, meaning AI that is much smarter than humans. You know, these companies might be wrong about whether they can build those things and how long it will take them, but they really mean it and they are really putting everything they have into trying to get there.
And that was Helen Toner, an Australian AI researcher who served on the board of artificial intelligence firm OpenAI. She was speaking with Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. So this morning, Radio National Breakfast covered a really difficult story, one that has been lacking from the headlines, but one that really shouldn't be. Here's how Sally Sarah introduced it live on the program.
Lavanya Chapper, Yana Armstrong, Layla Jeffrey, and a 17-year-old Yolngu girl. Two women and two teenage girls allegedly murdered by men known to them in just 1 week in Australia. Counting Dead Women Australia, a register that tracks homicides of women, says 27 Australian women have been killed so far in 2026. The string of tragedies is prompting new questions on what could really make a difference to an ongoing epidemic of violence against women and children. Michaela Cronin is the National Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner and joins me now. Commissioner, welcome back to Radio National Breakfast. How do we have these discussions when this is happening pretty much every week in Australia, but every now and again, with a grouping such as we've just listed, it grabs media attention again and we get shaken back into the core of this issue?
You're right, Sally. It is devastating when we see groups of women losing their lives like this, but it does happen every day. There are women and children in communities that are living with domestic, family and sexual violence every day, and we need to see much more coordinated action than we are seeing.
On average, one woman is killed by a current or former intimate partner every 9 days in Australia, every 9 days. Have we become numb to the scale of this epidemic of violence?
Sally, I don't think we're numb to it. I think every time this happens, we all feel devastated and heartbroken and want to see more change. And look, I am seeing really significant effort across government to address this. What we haven't seen enough of is coordinated action across the different states and territories, across all of the different portfolios in government who all have a role to play.
And it's important to note that in the cases we've mentioned, these are allegations at this stage. And while many cases of domestic and family violence are committed by men. It's not exclusively by men. What are we not getting right here in the time frame? Because often in cases of fatalities, there are very significant and escalating events in the lead up.
One of the things we need to get better at is recognising the difference in the pathways towards homicide. And there are differences. Sometimes, as you've described, when we look back where there were points of intervention where things could have happened, and we need to be addressing each of those. Sometimes it's about where people actually hadn't approached services. We know that people are most likely to speak first to and disclose to family members, to community members, to health professionals. Everybody needs to be educated about what the signs and the risks are and to be safely asking questions. But we also then need services that are adequately funded to respond to those levels of demand. We need much more funding to match the scale of the problem. And you've pointed out most of the violence is committed by men, not all of it. And every instance of domestic, family and sexual violence needs to be appropriately responded to. And every victim, no matter their gender, needs to get an appropriate response. But we do know it is predominantly men, and we need to understand men's violence and what the pathways are and how we can intervene and stop that violence early.
Is that message being heard?
I think it is beginning to be heard, yes. There is a shift, and we're currently going through a process of developing the second National Action Plan. And one of the priorities in that is looking at A, children and young people as early as points of needing support in their own right and early intervention, and pivoting much more to understanding men's violence.
Michaela Cronin there, the National Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner. It's been a pretty challenging conversation. So if it's raised any issues for you, help is available. You can call 1-800-RESPECT. That is on 1-800-737-732. Well, lastly, the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion is continuing its focus on universities today. Several Jewish students and academics have given evidence on incidents of violence, harassment and anti-Semitic behaviours that they've experienced on Australian campuses. One of them was Jewish professor Stephen Prower. He recounted an incident in 2024 when masked protesters took over his office. He says he was targeted because of his partnership with Hebrew University.
I don't know what their intentions were, but when a Jewish person with some experience of what happens in Israel sees a masked person, you can only see their eyes. The rest of them are covered with a keffiyeh. This was only 1 year after the atrocities in Israel, and so I was very perturbed. I had no idea at that stage if it was a protest, if it was a terrorist attack.
And that is Jewish professor Stephen Prower speaking at the Royal Commission. This morning, Sally Sarah spoke with Bill Shorten, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Canberra, and here's what she asked him first.
What's your reaction been to some of this evidence from students and also from an academic about incidents of anti-Semitism on Australian campuses?
I think it's shocking. It describes an Australia and a university, Australian universities that I don't recognise. But the fact is that these voices are revealing things which mean that there's no excuse to ignore them. There wasn't at the time, but so I feel very upset for Professor Prower and for the other witnesses. They've had to cope with things on their own, which no one should cope with regardless of where you work.
What does the current situation mean for those who may be protesting, those who are pro-Palestinian or other points of view who may wish to protest on campuses?
There's nothing wrong with protesting. One doesn't always want to refer to one's own experience, but I've been on strikes and marches and protests. But once people are putting coverings over their faces so they can't be identified, once they're going to people's individual offices, they've crossed a line. This is not a protest anymore. It's just bullying. It's thuggery. It's cowardice. It's intimidation. And I don't really care how righteous you think your cause is. You've got no right in this country to make someone else's life so scary, so miserable, so fearful, just because you happen to have a view. You are allowed to have conflicting views. Academic freedom is a really bedrock sort of proposition of universities. But there's no academic freedom which says you can behave like a bully and a thug. People having all these big existential arguments about, well, anti-Semitism mean you, a definition of anti-Semitism mean you can't criticise the government of Israel. Of course you can criticise the government of Israel. Israelis criticise the government of Israel. Again, it's not about your right to have a view or to exercise your right to express your political identity or values. But you don't have an unfettered right to the point that you make Australians of Jewish heritage feel unsafe to leave the house.
On a separate issue, debates around multiculturalism have intensified in recent months after Pauline Hanson, One Nation leader, called for a monoculture in Australia. Do you think this debate is influencing experiences of racism in Australia?
I'm not going to particularly tag a particular party, but let's go to the general principle. I've read this expression somewhere, but I'll apply it here. A sort of creeping cultural dementia across Australian political discourse where we're forgetting some of the basic memory of what makes this country such a special place. Like, you know, attacking people because of their Jewish heritage, that's never been part of our, I think, the country we want to be. And on the right, saying that we should go to zero immigration, it forgets how we got here. I could understand why perhaps some Aboriginal Australians might say, well, immigration hasn't been a success. But you know what? The other 97% of us, we all came from somewhere else. Because if we took immigration out of our health system, you'd have no one to turn the lights on. It's okay to have a view, but we've got to stop this sort of rush to extremism which extinguishes the our own country's history, which is a successful story of bringing things in. So, you know, I think, and this is where universities have a role to play. We've got to be encouraging diversity of speech, diversity of analysis. We've got to be encouraging critical thinking. But when I see people proposing very simplistic solutions and trying to put everything into a binary of the person I disagree with is the enemy, that intolerance, I think, is a form of political dementia where we're just shutting down our ability to think.
On the NDIS, Australians with Disabilities are awaiting the result of a Senate inquiry into proposed cuts to the National Disability Insurance Schemes. Many in the disabled community have been distressed by proposed cuts. You're a former NDIS minister. What do you make of the way the government is handling this process?
I think there's two things that have to be borne in mind here. One is the scheme is doing great things. It is far more successful than unsuccessful. It's changing lives of literally hundreds of thousands of people and their families for the better. It can't keep growing at double-digit growth. So the government does have to, in order to make sure the scheme keeps doing good things, make sure it's not growing too fast. So that's one thing. But the other thing is it is important on all of us, not just politicians, but in the media and people in public life generally, that when we talk about changes to the NDIS, remember that the mum who's got three kids with a diagnosis of autism who are on the scheme, someone who's got a family member with a early onset dementia or neurological condition, when they hear changes, they don't hear the word changes and reform. They hear, my God, I'm about to lose something which I fought hard for. So I think it's important in our language that we keep reminding that people with disability are not a burden. They're not a cost blowout. They're not an accounting entry. But I think it is important in the discourse that any change is measured against is in the best interests of the people on the scheme. So I think it's an important scheme which needs to be sustainable. So that's where the government's going right. But the language needs to be, always remember that there's vulnerable people at the end of this radio show and everyone else. And the way you talk about people with disability is crucial.
Bill Shorten there, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Canberra, who was speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Well, that is where we're going to leave the breakfast wrap for today. All of those interviews from Sally were produced by the breakfast team, and Shannon Schubert produced the breakfast wrap. I'm Lixit and Dunton. We'll be back in your ears tomorrow.